Live from the Nasdaq Market Site overlooking New York City's Times Square, this is Fast Money. I'm Melissa Lear. Traders on the desk are Tim Seymour, Brian Kelly, Steve Grasso, and Guy Dami. The clock, it's ticking. One top strategist says the countdown to recession is officially on. He will lay out his timeline and when he sees the market topping out. We also have a double dose of after-hours movers. Both Box and Williams-Sonoma moving lower after reporting results. We'll break down what's driving that action. And later, a royal rally, how King Dollar just got a big boost from the Queen. We will explain. But we begin with today's move higher. Stocks surging, with the Dow gaining more than 250 points. Energy, consumer discretionary, industrials all leading the way. This is a yield on the 30-year bond hit an all-time low. So, do you trust today's market rally? Guy Adami.
Hi, Melms. No, I definitely don't trust it, but I'll say this. You know, as we get in the later part of this week, into a holiday weekend, there's the old saying, Steve knows this from the floor, never short a dull market. So you could see this market sort of following through over the next couple days into early next week. But I'll say it again. I think this market will culminate on the downside when the VIX trades up to 30, which I think is going to happen. But with that said, there are trading opportunities here, and I'm going to do a power pitch in the back end of the show.
What are you going to do right now?
That's going to speak to exactly that.
Yeah.
So there's another saying, too, don't fight the Fed. So never short a dull market. Don't fight the Fed. You have both of them coming up right now.
Cancel each other out. No, got it.
It might. Because the Fed right now, you don't know which way the Fed is going to go. So you don't know which way you're fighting. So that, to me, is the caveat to whether the markets are safe to get back in or to stay in right now. But I am invested. I think the market is going high.
Right. You were mentioning earlier today on the call of financials, particularly regional banks, retail stocks. I mean, these are some of the most beaten down sectors of the market here.
Right. So history doesn't rhyme. It repeats itself. I don't know why I said that. Well, because we've seen these moments throughout the last 6 to 12 months where financials, which have largely underperformed, transports, which have underperformed for 18 months, have had these big snap out breakout days when you look like you're in an oversold condition. So what didn't make sense about today's tape to me was that you had a flight to quality in bonds. We actually tested the lows in the 10 years. We hit Sunday night when everyone was very worried. We had the dollar that was rallying a bit. You had some other dynamics that would be risk, you know, kind of risk off trades. Mm-hmm. And yet you had a huge move in small caps, a huge move in the XRT or the retail stocks and the transports. I think we have oversold conditions here. I think the reality of we are trading in a 100 S&P point range for the last month. That's it. With a fair amount of volatility and a whole lot of anxiety and a whole lot of people grinding and gnashing their teeth. And not much has happened. So I think today's breakout is nothing you say plant a flag in the ground and say this was the moment. But I do think when you get oversold, you get these bounces.
You got a chart.
I do.
What's your cliche?
So here's the, I don't know if I have a cliche. It's a market of stocks, not a stock market.
Nice.
I never really understood that one, but I'll use it for this. But, you know, what's interesting is that this chart was actually being passed around. I think it's been passed around for a week or so, but a trader sent it to me today, and it basically shows what people will call a megaphone top or a broadening top, technical formation. I'm not a technician, not going to play one on TV today.
Too late.
Oh, boy. But anyway, point is, what you get here is this broadening formation, and you usually get five touches on the line, right? And so what does this show us? What I found interesting about this is it shows us that we have effectively been trading in a very broad range with volatility expanding. And to me, that frightens me, because when volatility expands, you things break. And so I think this resolves to the downside. It certainly could go to the upside. I know we're going to have somebody talking about that in a minute or so. But to me, it just, that's a picture that visually shows what we talk about every night. Is it the trade war? Is it the Fed? Is it this? Is it that? And you have this massive volatility, very difficult to trade, and likely things break.
Can we put the chart up again? In terms of touching the line, does it have to alternate between highs and lows?
Yes.
So you
get that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
After number five, if we can put back up, it would go down to number six, which would be the orange line, which would be...
No, you don't get... At five is it.
Oh,
five's the number.
Five is
that's
it.
Apparently, that's it. All it goes.
It breaks
five is
after
it.
Five.
After
but you're
five,
saying a wide range. Is that right?
So the way to interpret this, as I'm told, is it either breaks violently higher or violently lower.
Interesting.
My view is that we break violently lower, but five is as many touches as you get, apparently, with the old megaphone top.
We used to always worry about, or we used to always say, there's no volatility left in the market. Now we have extreme versions of volatility. So, yes, I think both will be right. I think you could break lower and you could break higher. Both will probably happen, just which happens first. It's probably higher, in my opinion. You saw people reach for chemicals today. Mm-hmm. When was the last time they bought chemicals? I'm along TSC packaging.
And that makes you feel good about breaking higher?
Because they were so beaten up, people were trying to risk out, and they were so worried about global growth. Now they're buying those things that they threw out, which makes me potentially set up for a higher
market. That would be the glass half full interpretation of the market's moves today.
Well, I'm always a half empty, as you know. I mean, I was brought up in the Wall Street, what can go wrong will go wrong, another cliche. By the way, yours is history doesn't repeat itself. But it often writhes, but, you know.
I don't need to be corrected in public on a cliche that doesn't make sense.
You know what? I'm not sure. Now you're mad. I know the Mets had a tough night last night. We'll talk about that later.
What were you saying?
No, listen, I think the market over the next couple of days grinds slightly higher. I think people go on the weekend feeling good about themselves, thinking maybe we finally figured out what this inverted yield curve means. Maybe Tuesday you have another decent day. But I think things are going to get really interesting in the first couple of weeks of September. And I told BK walking in here, October is going to be a historic month for a number of different asset classes, specifically the one that BK knows the most about.
Everyone's made a point that's been somewhat kind of emphatic about the conditions here. I would argue that we haven't seen anything yet in terms of volatility, even though I think people felt like we've had a big, and I think we've traded in a very tight range here, despite the divergence of outcomes we could have here. So I hate to do this, but it's a very quiet week. It could explain some of the subdued. We also get violent moves in these types of weeks. I think you have a major expectation of a rebalance out of bonds into equities at the end of the month. This is something that I've been talking about.
Or it could have happened already.
That may have been even just the bid to the market today. You got this sense. And therefore, really oversold stuff would be a rotation in for relative value players. As we've echoed and we've unfortunately had to address almost nightly on this show, there's nothing about the trade war that's changed. Hong Kong is still a tinderbox. You have a dynamic with the Fed that's still unproven. 50 now, maybe more in the lexicon of where the market is right now, except for the fact that I'm listening to a Fed, which doesn't really sound like, to a man, they want to go 50. And if anything, I still think that that's the most important dynamic for the market.
You're the only one on this desk that thinks the market could break higher. So what would you buy here in this environment?
I'd buy the things that have not worked, because today, if today is any indication of where you should be going, it's energy and it's chemicals, the things that haven't worked. Because we know if there's brighter headlines on the trade front, all of those large cap tech names, all the semiconductor space, everything that is quote unquote trade related will rip higher. But the best bang for your buck are the things that have not performed that start to perform now.
All right. Well, the countdown is officially on, apparently. Canaccord Genuity's Tony Dwyer says the clock is now ticking. Look at that clock. Ticking. On a recession and the market peak, 24 months, 0 days, this is about 19 months. That's how we calculate it. But Tony says the market will rally more than 15% until the recession kicks in. He's over at the Plasma to chart it out. Tony.
Well, thanks, Mel. You know, Wall Street's filled with strategists that tell you something, they come on, and when it actually gets there, they change. And I'm not going to be that guy. I don't think it's different this time. What you notice on this chart is all those gray shaded areas are recessions. What happens every single time prior to a recession? Sure enough, you get a yield curve inversion of the 210. Okay, this one was a 39% rally prior to recession. This one led to this was 34% rally before the recession in the peak of the market. This was 39%, and this was 29%. So I think we're going to go actually a lot more than 15%. I think we'll do 15% in the next year, but it actually takes about 2 years. If you look at the last three cycles, the average gain has been 34%. The median gain has been 34% over 22 months. How do you know then? When is it time? Like, these numbers are great. Who cares about a median? How do you know it's time to get really defensive? It's time to get defensive when corporate credit really starts to act poorly. What you'll see here is prior to the recession, you had a bottom in the Moody's Baa. This is the lowest level of investment grade bonds. This is the average yield of those lowest level of investment grade bonds. It made a low 2 years before you went into a recession. We just made a record low. It was a record low. It was the only second time in the history of the Moody's Baa index since 1962 that the 10-week rate of change dropped to minus 15. That's not signaling that money is shutting down. Money shutting down is what causes a recession. And then lastly, the Fed, stunningly, the Fed is yet to get really ahead of the market. How do you know when it's ahead of the market? I believe they will, which is one of the reasons I still think the market's going to go up. How do you know they're not ahead of the market? Because this is the current lower bound of the Fed funds rate, and these are the 2 and 10-year note yields. Like, I don't need to be a master economist, because I'm not, to know that the Fed is behind the market when you're 50 basis points below the Fed funds.
I think Tony comes over. What do you think?
Yeah. Why did he? I mean, you never asked.
I'm just joking.
Mel exerts kind of like I'm in charge kind of mentality and does what she wants to do.
Right.
Good point. Which she should do, by the way.
I brought paperwork.
Wow.
Very prepared, Tony. I like
your
style.
Oh, no, I got to read you something, Mel. You're going to love it.
Oh, you're going to read it? I don't even get
a question. No, I thought
you did your little thing at the plaza.
I'm waiting.
Okay. So here's my question. If people believe that there's this rule of thumb that you have a certain amount of time after this, you know, indicator flashes a recession signal, doesn't that time, the more people know about this lag time, doesn't that time period get compressed?
So it's a great question. And I went back and I read my prior notes because I want to make sure that I'm not full of it either. And in all those prior notes, every time it
reading
feels
your notes,
like
by the way,
different.
Doesn't make you less full of it.
It made me more, but
definitely more full of it. But the reason that I did that is to make sure that it isn't different this time, that I was saying the same thing back in the last cycle. And what creates that lead time is the 10-year note yield dropped so much. We've gone from 3.25 to in the 1.4 level.
Right.
That's extraordinarily stimulative because bank lending hasn't quite shut down yet. So there's still money moving around, and it just got really cheaper, and you're still at full employment. So you have this money that kind of surges into the market because that drop in the 10-year, and then it kind of shuts down, and the time it takes to put that money to work is what causes that lead time. But you get this little kind of bump in the economy. So you're like, maybe it is different this time, but it's not different this time.
In the past times, I'm curious also, where does that 10-year yield typically drop from, and does that make a difference? Because some could argue that a drop, and we've been sub 2 for a long time,
that's
even
right.
though we've been at more than 3, what, November of last year or so.
Yeah.
We've been sub 2 for so long that people could say that there was money being borrowed at those very low levels anyway. So every incremental drop in the 10-year doesn't lead to incremental borrowing on the part of corporations, which won't lead to incremental spending later on.
It does at the household level. There is no question. And Karen has brought this up a lot in the last couple of times I've been on. There's no question industrial spending and corporate spending has come down because of the trade war. That is not debatable. Household spending, however, is what is more sensitive to the drop in rates. So there's this idea in the marketplace that the lower risk premia and the global overseas negative yields has created this artificial suppression in the long end, which is, means that this may not be a good recession indicator. And what I brought to read is a quote, if you don't mind, Mel. Just listen to this for a sec.
Doesn't sound
apparently
like
there's
not.
Been a good bit of evidence
like.
That the declines in the term premium and perhaps a great deal of savings chasing a limited number of investment opportunities around the world have led to a somewhat permanent flattening or even inversion of the yield curve, and that pattern does not necessarily predict a slowing in the economy or recession. Ben Bernanke, February 2007. Mm. Hmm. So that quote is saying the global... low global interest rates is creating demand for the U.S. product that's artificially suppressing the long end of the curve. Mm. So we've done this before.
And now it didn't go very well, though.
It didn't go well. It was a much different cycle, but it didn't go very well, Tim, as you know.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, Tony. So if we're going to get this rip higher and the economy is going to look to improve, Stephen Grasso said today that people are buying chemicals, part of the cyclicals. Is that the best place to be?
In the earlier segment, you guys were talking about, Timmy was talking about how bonds came down and it's kind of surprising that stocks went up. Inflation break-evens actually upticked today. It was this morning when I think it became a pervasive story on the street that Bill Dudley came out with his op-ed on Bloomberg that suggested you don't want to have policy that allows for President Trump to win a second term. Now, nobody on the set or anywhere knows my political bias. That's not my job. But you have a vice chairman of the former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve openly stating that the risk to the market or the risk to the economy is President Trump, and you don't want to pursue this policy because it might help him. That right there gave the Fed the flexibility to become aggressively accommodative, as I've been suggesting lately. Why? Because right now they have to prove that they're not kowtowing to President Trump. Now they have to prove on that op-ed, they have to prove that they're not biased against President Trump. They have to prove their independence. So you remove both tail risk. And now what can they follow? Their own inflation break-evens, which has 5-year forward inflation at 1.5%. They want 2%. If you don't do anything, how are you going to get 2% if it's at 1.5%? So that's what really, I think, is going to kickstart this rally that goes toward the peak. But a lot of people on the show, you know, I've been a permeable. I've been bullish for 10 years, right? What changes that? I've always said the 210 curve inversion changes that tone. Now I'm watching those credit indicators to make sure it's not going sideways.
Thanks, Tony.
Thank
Tony
you, Mike.
Tony Dwyer, Canaccord Genuity.
That's good. Isn't he good?
Ah,
we could use a box.
Just kidding.
I was nervous. He had another piece of paper hanging on him, too. So there's a couple of issues with that. The problem is, during those other recessions, the Fed had about 5 or 6 percentage points to bail the economy out. So they don't have that. So I'm worried about if the market is pricing in something cataclysmic after all that happens. And you also want to hunt yield. So stick with what's been performing as well. So the utilities can have a further leg higher in this economy.
Okay.
Look, I think the Fed could cut rates from here to eternity. They're not going to get the inflation they desire, and they think they can somehow manufacture it. I think history has proven that they can do anything but.
Tim, quick.
Utilities are up 32% from the beginning of the trade war. You tell me what's going to reverse that trend. I'm not sure.
All right, coming up, Box and Williams-Sonoma, both on the move after hours, will give you the highlights from their quarters. But first, Facebook's 2020 vision, the social media giant seeing some major money moves ahead of next year's election. We'll break down who's driving the big spend. We're live in Times Square in New York City. Much more Fast Money right after this. Welcome back to Fast Money. Facebook back in the political spotlight once again. Ad spending among Democratic presidential hopefuls skyrocketing as a race for the White House heats up. Our very own Julia Borson is in Los Angeles with more on this spending spree. Hi, Julia.
Hi, Melissa. Well, despite the manipulation on Facebook around the last presidential election, the fact that the platform offers such a great opportunity to narrowly target voters is once again making it a destination, this time for Democratic hopefuls. The Wall Street Journal reporting that a political action committee focused on turning out Asian American voters saw the cost of generating just one email address for its supporter or donor list skyrocket to $279 from $9 or less. Now, it does make sense that the price hikes would be happening now. The deadline to qualify for the next debate is at midnight, and Democratic presidential hopefuls have been spending big to reach the donor and polling threshold necessary to be included. Now, it's not that Facebook is trying to take advantage of a surge of interest. Prices are set, rather, by demand in Facebook's auction advertising system. Facebook did not weigh in on the reported increase in those ad prices, but it did say, quote, our ad auction is designed to promote a diversity of advertisers, not just those who bid more. It takes into consideration whether the ad will be interesting and relevant for the person seeing it. And all of this comes as Facebook ramps up its requirements for political advertisers. Now, political advertisers have to go beyond just verifying their identity and location. Now they have to provide information about their organization and who is funding their ads, including either their tax ID number, a government website domain, or Federal Election Commission number. Now, all of this is just Facebook's latest move to protect the 2020 election from any manipulation and also to ramp up transparency about who is on the platform and what they're doing and what they're spending money on. Back over to you, Melissa.
All right, Julia. Thank you, Julia Borston. How many candidates on the Democratic side?
20, but whittling down.
Still counting. Yeah. Still counting.
So that's a huge
and one loss.
There's a lot of spending, and it worked in the last election. That's what everybody's saying, is that, listen, if you go out and do this ad spending, this digital ad spending, it works. So I think certainly Facebook gets a tailwind from it. But the name in the social that I actually like that looks like it wants to break out is the Twitter machine, Twitter, TWTR. I think that's the one you buy on a breakout.
Hmm. I think Facebook is also just their core business is working. You're seeing e-commerce. You're seeing actually lead in commercial usage. You're seeing Instagram finally starting to pay some dividends. I think if you're going to make the election kind of tailwind argument for Facebook, I think you have to make it for Twitter. I think ultimately Twitter to me is going to be the greatest beneficiary of a company that's actually starting to see revenue growth, low teens, ad sales, you know, high 20s. That to me is a lot more interesting.
If it's going to be a tailwind for these guys, is it also going to be a tailwind for traditional media?
It has to be. And they always say it's a boon for traditional media. The problem is media gets caught up in that bullseye of cord cutting and do they have a streaming product? So it gets a little muddy. But Facebook had every reason to collapse and keep collapsing. It's up 38%. It's doing the best out of all the FANG names. I would probably stay there.
It is, but, you know, it's also had some pretty big moves along the way. I mean, it's in December, this was $125 stock, and we talked about this thing. You know, I get a lot wrong. One of the things we got right was the fact that into this quarter, Facebook would retest that all-time high we saw in July, and that's exactly what happened. You have pretty much a huge double top now around 211. The point is this. I think it trades down to 165 thereabouts, which is sort of the 50% correction of the entire move we've seen this year. And I agree with both Tim and BK that I think Twitter is your bet.
All right. For more on the big money social spend ahead of the election, you can head on over to our website, CNBC.com. I'm Melissa Lee. You're watching Fast Money on CNBC. Here's what else is coming up on the show.
Call it a royal rally. The King Dollar just got a big boost from the Queen. We'll explain. And later, Guy is stepping up to the plate to pitch his next big idea. Why he thinks one big bank could be a home run investment. All that's on deck when Fast Money returns.
Welcome back to Fast Money. We've got an earnings whip on some after-hours movers. Williams-Sonoma and Box, both on the move after reporting. We've got full team coverage. Contessa Brewer standing by on WSM. Let's start off with Josh Lipton in San Francisco with Box. Josh.
So, Melissa, you know, you talk to analysts who cover Box, and one point of concern they'll point out is this company's growth rate. 2 years ago, they say around 30%, now roughly half that. I did get the chance to speak to Aaron Levy, Box's CEO, and I asked him about that point, and Aaron acknowledged, listen, Box needs, he said, to grow faster. Said, they're advancing their product portfolio, so trying to deliver more solutions for customers. Pointed out they're standardizing and simplifying their go-to-market strategy. Also, Melissa, just more broadly, I did want to get his take on just the state and health of IT spending here more broadly. Aaron's saying the IT market remains, in his words, fairly stable, though noted that trade disputes, tariffs do not make for a stable macro environment. On the call here, Melissa, he's hammering home on these same themes, pointing out, listen, we're evolving the product, we're introducing new products, we're working hard, he said, to improve go-to-market efforts. Noted that they are making progress, in his words, on training, for example, 36% growth in $100,000 deals. Noted the large install base of customers, the strong product roadmap, making the case that he sees real opportunities ahead. But you can see that stock down right now. And remember, Mel, heading into this print, it was already down nearly 50% over the last 12 months. Back to you.
All right, Josh. Thank you. Josh Lipton in San Francisco. I mean, we heard similar sentiments from Autodesk, different businesses, but sort of the same kind of tech sector, same tariff trade headlines.
And so you said, I mean, the quarter in and of itself, it wasn't a horrible quarter, and the guidance, the full year guidance wasn't horrible either. It comes down to valuation, and still probably close to 70 times forward earnings. It's just too expensive in this environment where people are looking for growth. It's been cut in half over the last year. July of last year was 27.13 now. I don't think you buy it yet. I think you got to wait for the flush. We haven't seen it.
I agree with that. EPS, Box has beaten EPS 100% of the time and beat on revenues 75% of the time. So the fact that they beat doesn't mean that you should be out buying the stock. The CEO nailed it. They have to grow quicker. If they're still losing money, you have to get a much larger growth rate to be a buyer of the stock.
I just think they're in such a commoditized space to be growing 16% to finally be competing with, you bet, that's right, Amazon, Microsoft. I mean, I just don't see it for a company at this multiple in this environment. So, no, I don't even wait for a flush.
All right, let's move on to a retail triple play. Five Below, PVH, Williams-Sonoma, all moving after hours. Contessa Brewer's on all of those stories at headquarters. Contessa.
Hi there, Melissa. Yep, back to school for Five Below, beloved for cheap pencils, phone chargers, and a superb candy selection. Delivered third quarter guidance that wasn't so sweet. CEO Joel Anderson says it reflects the current tariff situation and the timing of their efforts to mitigate the impact. The company stands out, though, for its willingness to tackle the impact of tariffs and expects they'll increase as scheduled throughout the fall. Stock and extended trading, we did see it dip somewhat right after they reported. Now, but you can see just off slightly 0.5% or so. All right, PVH, fancy clothes by Tommy Hilfiger, Calvin Klein, Michael Kors, and lots of others delivered matching top and bottom line beats, but weak guidance for the third quarter. CEO Manny Chirico says North America and China had weak traffic trends. That includes the impact of the protests in Hong Kong, so the company had to dress up their promotions to lure in the customers. The shares after hours just off slightly. Williams-Sonoma really cooking when it comes to home furnishings. Comp sales up 6.5%, where analysts were expecting 3.3%. The real spice in these numbers, West Elm, which the CEO calls its biggest growth opportunity, comp revenue up more than 17%. And while the company raised full-year guidance, the implied outlook for the second half is lukewarm.
Stock counted right at now. Least three puns from you.
The spice.
Are they
fantastic.
Puns? Are they really puns, or is it just creative words. Writing?
You can call it whatever.
We
you
love
want.
Puns.
Contessa Brewer. So, again, the impact of China tariffs.
The impact of tariffs, particularly PVH. I mean, they're not necessarily as high-end as Louis Vuitton. Those are the ones that really got hurt during the China tariffs. But, I think this story about retail, mixed bag here and there. Williams-Sonoma, not a lot of people buying pots. But I guess Contessa went out on a limb with the West Elm.
Contessa's puns or creative writing was much better than Brian's. I will say that I like Williams-Sonoma here. This is a company that's trading it with that new guidance and that's raised guidance. You're at 14.5 times 2019. This is part of the housing trade to me. This is part of the Home Depot trade. When you go to Home Depot, you're probably stopping at Williams-Sonoma to outfit Brian. I don't know. You're probably not buying pots and pans, but maybe a new toaster.
An apron.
Maybe
an apron.
Some fresh napkins.
Muffin mitts.
Yeah.
Anyway, I've got some nice copper
very
pots,
interesting. Good
but
comps.
I did get a Williams-Sonoma.
The problem with Williams-Sonoma is you're running into massive resistance here around $70 to $72. 2018, September 2018, 72 was your resistance. Right now, it's around $70. So I would wait, looking at the chart, trading at 67.30-ish. Wait until it blows through that 70 mark before you dabble in that name.
Used to have this beautiful pashmina that you used to wear on the desk. Remember?
From, me? From the CEO of Five Below.
Not you,
Steve.
Melissa.
Yeah.
And I tell you, I actually like Five Below.
It had little pineapples
on it. It was fantastic.
Great store.
It was really nice.
Guy, do you have any pashminas?
Of course I do. As we get into the autumnal months, I'll
what do you
start
feed
to bring them
this one.
Sweet laugh track.
Anyway,
listen, margins were better. The guidance wasn't terrible. And at 32 times, given their EPS growth rate and given the 20% sales growth rate of last quarter, I think this stock, off from its all-time highs, is worth a buy right here.
Coming up, the greenback rallying today and some big Brexit drama across the pond. We'll break down one way to play the dollar's dominance. But first, Guy is making his fast pitch comeback with one stock that he says will knock it out of the park. Find out what the name is when we come right back. More Fast Money right after this.
I think the market is now behind Google. I think Google's ahead of the market. I think Google will sort of hang around here as the market goes down. That's when you want to buy Alphabet.
That was Guy's pitch back in May for Google. Since that call, Alphabet's up nearly 2%, but it saw a big boost off its recent earnings report. So what do you do now, Guy?
Yeah, the timing was pretty lousy because if you go back and look, it really cratered in June. So the timing was bad. I think you stay with it, although I do think the market is vulnerable here. I think valuation suggests, last quarter suggests that Google's probably figured it out. So I would stay with Alphabet, the Google-L.
The Google-L. You got another fast pitch for us. Why don't you hand on over
I'm going to head over to the smart board right now. I love the power pitch, maybe more than anybody in the history of Fast Money. And you're going to be shocked at what I'm about to pitch you. We sort of teased it at the top of the show. Hold your hate Twitter, folks. But here it goes. I'm going to power pitch Citi. And you're going to be like, wait a second. You've been so negative on banks, especially Citi, European exposure. What are you talking about? And you're right on all those levels. But sometimes you have to make a trading call. I absolutely think banks go lower in the early part of next year, if not October. But in the short term, I think you can see a rally. Trading at a discount, what does that mean? Well, Citi just reported, they said tangible book was roughly $68. Citi yesterday traded below 62. When it typically gets to that kind of discount, it's been a buying opportunity. Number two, I think the bond market is overextended. I think rates continue to go lower, but in the short term, you might have seen a top in the TLT. Maybe rates tick higher. That should be positive for banks as well. And third, it did. It held critical support. We're going to pull up a chart and show you. Dan Nathan actually mentioned this the other night, but the $60 level in Citi has been decent support. So if you go back and look, bless you over there on the side, 60's actually held a couple of times. So although I don't like the banks long term, and I think Citi has tremendous issues, I think for a trade, Citi sets up really well over the next week and a half.
Hey, Guy.
Hi, Tim.
Appreciate your sensitivity to the guy coughing off stage. I like the fact that Citi is up there for you because I like the pick. I'm long the pick. But I'm very concerned about their net interest margins. And that is something for a money center bank. And if you looked at the last quarter's numbers, which were fine, is a big area of concern.
For all the banks, and I think Citi as well, the numbers have been really poor. And again, I think their European exposure is one of the reasons the stock has traded so poorly. I don't think the banks are fixed at all, and I think the points you bring up for the long term suggest banks go lower. In the short term, though, and we've seen this before, I think you can see a 12 to 14% bounce in a name in a market that goes sideways to slightly higher in a segment that's still probably going lower longer term.
Hey, Guy, it's BK, longtime listener, first-time caller.
Hi,
great
Brian.
Power pitch there. I'm curious, we have a Fed meeting coming up in September, potentially maybe trying to re-steepen the yield curve. Is that the catalyst for this trade?
Maybe. You've talked about this Operation Twist. A lot of hockey fans remember Tony Twist. I totally digress. Don't. You might want to look that up. But, yes, that absolutely could be a catalyst. Again, this is a trade. This is more trade than investment. I think this is short term. When I say short term, over the next couple of weeks. And again, you've seen stocks like Citi rally 8, 10, 12% in a 2-week time. And to your point, maybe that twist, that Operation Twist, if the Fed talks about it, will be the catalyst to get this trade done.
No more questions. Time to vote. Are you buying Guy's pitch on Citi, Grasso?
I'm buying it. And for the same reason, on a technical basis, if you look at that $60 level, that has held and been great support back to January of this year. But I guess Guy would probably, I would estimate that Guy would agree with me on this. If it does break below 60, that's probably the way to exit or puke the trade.
BK.
You know what? I came into this thinking I was not going to say buy. You probably can't read this. But I'm going to say buy. Guy convinced me. He completely changed my mind for trade.
Tim.
And a triple.
Joker and a triple.
Wow. Ultimately, money center banks did very well in this last quarter. I love the fact that the capital ratios are going down. Why? Because they're paying out more. Banks are actually becoming proper div plays. Again.
Three buys on the desk. You know what that means, Guy.
Means I'm going to lose.
Tony Braxton tonight. But you guys at home, you can vote on Guy's pitch on Citi. Our Twitter poll is up at CNBC Fast Money. We'll reveal the results later on in the show. Coming up next, King Dollar just got a big boost from the Queen of England. Why the greenback may be setting up for a royal rally. Stick with us. Fast Money's back right after this.
Delivering Alpha, the most important investor summit 9 years running. Strategy from leading alpha generators. Direct access to policymakers and government leaders. On September 19th, see who's calling the shots now. Go to deliveringalpha.com to attend this year's blockbuster event.
You will come away with ideas that you can put to work immediately.
Plus, special guest Vice President Mike Pence talks economy and trade war impact. Reserve your spot now at deliveringalpha.com.
Welcome back to Fast Money. The pound getting pounded today, ooh, falling as much as 1% against the dollar. This is UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson doubled down on Brexit. Johnson moving to temporarily shut down Parliament, preventing lawmakers from passing any new bills that would stop the UK from crashing out of the EU. Basically, he asked the Queen if she would suspend the Parliament. She said yes. So the Parliament won't come back until just days before a key EU summit ahead of Brexit.
Right. So this obviously is a political tactic. Frankly, it stunned me. It stunned me that the market didn't react more to this. But the net of this is what you're starting to see is countries start to. It's one more shot in the currency war, because as the pound goes down, people go into the Swiss franc. The Swiss National Bank said that's too strong. They're going to intervene. And it just creates more chaos. We talked about this volatility. That's coming from the currency market. So, if we're looking into the fall and what can break, currency markets can break.
Mm-hmm. And obviously they go into the dollar too, the U.S. dollar.
Right. So just to remind you, if you're looking for the weightings of the dollar index, here they are. It's about 58% euro, almost actually closer to 60 now. It's 12% pound. It's about 14% Japanese yen and a sprinkling of other European currencies. So historically, to me, the pound rising against the dollar has been a very good sign for risk assets and reflation trades, along with the 5-year part of the curve, without getting too deep into global macro. Seeing the pound fall is nothing positive for me as an asset allocator.
Yeah. And the impact on U.S. companies?
It should be, maybe not as significant as this whole yuan situation that we've seen. But in terms of what's going on in currencies, we can talk about a currency war. I think BK would agree with this. At a certain point, it becomes a currency crisis. And the difference is, in a war, you can control things. In a crisis, you can't. And I think we're on the verge of that, which is why gold still works and which is why BK's Bitcoin will probably still work.
Yeah, I would have said the opposite, by the way. By definition, in a war, you can't control a war because a war is, a crisis is measured, right?
It's interesting.
Yeah, so the currency crisis comes when you run out of reserves and you can't do anything. That's the crisis part of it. And there's a couple countries that are looking at that right now. Turkey, South Africa, those are the two. But it all stems from a strong dollar, which hurts U.S. multinationals.
Some might make the argument that we will lose the war if we choose to go into a war because we don't have the reserves to actually prop up the U.S. dollar. We don't have the firepower on our own to unilaterally prop up the U.S. dollar.
We don't want a strong dollar, though. That's going
to
hurt.
To intervene and weaken the dollar.
Well, sure, you could print a ton of dollars. You could just print more dollars. Increase supply. Dollar will go straight down. And by the way, as a Bitcoin holder, please do.
And by the way,
that's
the other alternative. They could use the balance sheet again. So they stopped the quantitative tightening. If they ever went back to quantitative easing, that would do it.
All right. Well, the strong dollar could mean even more good news for the mighty U.S. consumer. Mike Coe's out in San Francisco with more on a big bullish bet in the options market. Mike, what are you seeing?
Yeah, it's interesting because, of course, just in the second half now of August, we haven't seen that much options activity. Pete was alluding to this yesterday, below average in most cases. But XRT actually traded well over 10 times its average daily call volume today. And on a low volume for the options market, that's a particular standout. And where we saw that activity was the September 6th weekly 40 strike calls. Somebody paid about a quarter for 20,000 of those. That's making a bullish bet that XRT could rise above that 40 strike price by at least a quarter that they paid. That's going to be a week from this coming Friday. So that's a short-term bullish bet, trying to take advantage of the fact that options look very fairly priced here, a bullish bet for one of the sectors that hasn't performed all that well this year.
This is sort of what we talked about right in the A block. Do you trust this bounce in some of these sectors? And we named retail specifically. Grasso?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't you think that the worst is over for a lot of these retail names, or the fact that they've priced in a heck of a lot to the downside? I don't know if you can. I always use this argument that it's not priced in until it's priced in. Mm-hmm. But I would think that there's a heck of a lot of headwinds that have already been established, already been assumed in the retail space. But stick with the winners. Stick with the Ross Stores. Stick with the TJ Maxx's. Stick with the Walmart. Stick with the Costco's. Don't go into the deep end of the pool on names that have not performed well.
Mike, this is a short-term trade, granted, but, I mean, what's your feeling on what they've priced in? Because maybe what the retail stocks have not priced in is an increase in the new tariffs that they could face, particularly after December 15th.
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, we were just talking about currencies. Some of those currency issues have been a little bit of an offset for the tariffs, haven't they? So that's one thing that we could certainly take a look at. We have also seen some standouts. I mean, Target obviously performed very well. Depot performed very well. Costco is a retail upside surprise earlier this week, net of that store opening in China. So not all of the news is bad necessarily. And of course, the other issue is, where are you going to put your money? I think that might be one of the reasons that people are doing this. And on top of all of that, with the volatility we're seeing and options prices not being up as much as we might otherwise think that they should be, that's probably why we're seeing them use that to make their short-term bullish bets here.
All right, Mike, thanks for that. Mike Cohen, San Francisco. For more options action, tune into the full show. That's this Friday, 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Coming up, the 30-year yield sinking to its lowest level on record. So that got us in the mood to do a little yield hunting. Up next, the best places to stash your cash. We are live at the Nasdaq in Times Square. Much more Fast Money still ahead. Welcome back to Fast Money. A rate wreck on Wall Street with the yield on a 30-year bond tumbling below 2% to its lowest level on record. The long bond is now officially yielding less than the S&P 500 dividend yield for the first time in a decade. Meantime, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin out in just the past hour or so saying a 50- or 100-year bond, an ultra-long bond, is under very serious consideration. This he told Bloomberg.
Yeah, which makes sense financially, right? Why wouldn't you go out and borrow money at effectively, no cost to you? And so I think that certainly makes sense in terms of I'm looking at it financially. In terms of how much debt we have, that's a whole different story. But when you look at kind of the 30-year bond at a $1.93, mm-hmm. you have to say to yourself, in 30 years, is it going, sometime in the next 30 years, are rates going to be higher or lower than this? And I think it's a pretty safe bet to say they're going to be higher at some point.
What would that do to the yield curve? I mean, theoretically, if an ultra-long bond is yielding however many basis points above the longest current bond, 30-year, then does that steepen the curve?
Make the curve
yes.
longer.
It just makes the curve longer.
You will have a pivot in the curve in the long end. And we've seen this. We've seen this in a couple corporate issues. We've seen this in some of the biggest companies in the world that have been able to do it. This does shift some of your liability and your duration risk, and it is a smart thing to do. It's something the European Union, I think, should be doing.
All right, with the 30-year bond now yielding less than the S&P, we decided to play a little game of would you rather.
Oh, I love this game.
Yield hunting style. We picked four stocks in the S&P that are yielding more than the long bond. So we kick things off with Nordstrom, yielding more than 5% compared to 1.9% on the 30-year. So, Tim, which would you rather?
To me, the 30-year bond, no question I would rather own. I would rather the 30-year bond.
Over Nordstrom.
5% in Nordstrom is 20 minutes of trading on a bad day. It's not the reason to go out and buy this stock. It's a company that right now is down 38% in a year when, in fact, we've answered no questions about the company. The only bid to the stock really comes when you talk about a takeout. And I'm not even sure at what price that would be. So 30-year bond.
Next up, Wells Fargo yielding just over 4%. Would you rather Wells Fargo or the 30-year bond?
Yeah, so this comes down to a time frame, right? Because if I'm looking at why is the 30-year bond down is because we think bond yields are going even lower, which is not going to be good for Wells Fargo in the relatively short term. So I did that whole thing about 30 years. The only person who has a 30-year time frame is Warren Buffett.
Let's say it's a year.
It's a one-year time frame. Yeah. Then I want to buy 30-year bonds all day long and twice on Sunday.
Wow.
Yeah.
Johnson & Johnson yielding around 3% right now. Steve, would
had
you rather?
Every reason to go, would I rather? I'm going to say Johnson & Johnson. Let's get that out right now. It's around 3%. So it's not that much of a difference. I think the market's going higher. So I think equities are going higher. I think Johnson & Johnson had a bunch of people caught off sides. I think they are reestablishing long positions. Johnson & Johnson.
This one's an interesting one. Mm. Apache yielding 4.5% right now. 30-year bond or Apache, guys?
When does the duck come out of
there's
the bull?
Would you rather? No, read the graphics?
Would you rather yield hunting?
Not yield hunting.
Yield edition.
Not yield hunting, guys.
Can we not confuse these things?
It's hard for me.
Pay attention.
Listen, Apache was a $50 stock in October. It's a $21 stock now. So it wipes out the dividend very quickly. It has bounced over the last year, year and a half, but the bounces have been short-lived. So to answer your question, I think I'm in the BK. Tim Camp.
Wow.
The 30-year bond, like J-Wow, O-W-W.
With an extra W.
Extra W.
Up three next, W's. Final J-Wow. Trades.
Who knew?
The moment you've been waiting for, it is time to reveal if you at home are buying Guy's pitch on Citigroup. Sorry, Guy.
Oh, I thought this was the one.
And the dance
60% said no, they are not buying your pitch on Citi. I think it was forecasted because we had three buys on the desk.
Yeah.
You know who's voting for this and who's not voting for him? Toni Braxton. She wants to hear the song every night.
It's an excellent
I know.
Why do we not figure this out?
True.
Have we invited her? About. Why do you take such glee when I get eviscerated in these games? You do.
I take glee when everybody gets eviscerated. Equal evisceration. Time for the final trade. Tim.
Yeah, Williams-Sonoma. Again, this is part of the housing trade that I think is, you know, could also have Sharon Williams in there. But the bottom line is 15 times they upped their guidance, 7.5% comp. Like it.
BK.
So we talked about lower rates. We talked about currency wars. We talked about a potential recession. You know what does well in all those? Gold, Newmont Mining. I think you look at that one.
Steve.
Chemical space and a yield play. 5% yield. TSE is the ticker. That's how it comes out. I'm there. It's gotten beat up in stock price. I think it's going to recover. TSE.
A shout out to the great high school football players of Georgia. They played in the Corky Kell over the weekend, and they all watched Fast Money. Mel, I know you find that hard to believe. Citibank for all you people that voted no.
See you back here tomorrow at 5 for more Fast Money. Don't go anywhere. Mad Money with Jim Cramer starts right now.